7 Democrats, and then they had one Supreme Court justice who was an independent, David Davis. In most states at that time, United States senators were selected by the state legislatures. And Justice Davis, unfortunately, by poor timing or by clever gimmickry, was selected by, I believe it was Colorado, to become a U.S. senator and had to vacate his seat on the commission. There were no other independents on the Supreme Court. So they finally settled on a Republican, and the result was that all of the votes of the commission were along party lines. Hayes would have won were it not for the fact that the commission decision went to Congress, and the Democrats, in a last-ditch effort, objected to one previously undisputed Wisconsin delegate. After an unruly debate that lasted until 3:30 a.m. on the morning of inauguration, they reached a compromise, and Rutherford Hayes became president. In the aftermath of that debacle, Congress passed Title III, Section 5 of the U.S. Code, which, if you're wondering why I've been talking about that, leads us to the 2000 election. That provision provided that if a state makes a final determination of the Electoral College delegates at least 6 days prior to the meeting of the Electoral College, that determination is conclusive and beyond the reach of Congress. It would no longer be subject to the same type of congressional shenanigans as 1876. The courts have referred to that provision as the safe harbor provision. Compliance with the safe harbor provision in this case was critical to Al Gore for a reason that we will learn in a few moments. In 2000, the safe harbor date was December 12th. 124 years after the Tilden Hayes election, Americans again awoke to an undecided election. And for the following 36 days, Tallahassee was transformed from a quiet North Florida town into the center of the world. The first case was not actually filed by Gore or by Bush. It was filed by a Palm Beach County resident challenging the butterfly ballot. Butterfly ballot was a booklet with the names of candidates on both sides, and a stylus was used to punch holes in the center of the booklet. It was confusing, particularly for the elderly. Gore was the second on the left. Buchanan was the first on the right. But Gore was not the second hole. He was the first hole. Buchanan was the second hole. And here's the result. Palm Beach County, which was Buchanan's worst demographic in the state, was where he received the highest vote in the state. No other county gave Buchanan anywhere near the vote he got in Palm Beach County. The following day, the candidates themselves, Bush and Gore, joined the battle. They were challenged because an election can be challenged either of two ways. Before the results are certified, a candidate can request manual recounts in any counties, not less than 3. Or the candidate can await until after the results are certified, in this case by the Secretary of State, and file an election contest in the circuit court. Gore elected to file a protest. The protest has these advantages. It has the advantage of control, because the candidate can select which counties to request the recount, the manual recount in. It has the advantage of speed, because the contest requires a full evidentiary trial. It has the advantage of a lower burden than at a trial, because the canvassing boys that conduct the manual recount have a wide degree of discretion, wider than a judge would have in a trial. And finally, it gives the candidate a second bite at the apple. Because if the candidate is not successful in the manual recounts on the protest, the candidate can still file an election contest later. We didn't know that until 2000, but we certainly know it now. Gore's decision, however, to go the protest route carried a big risk, loss of time. Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, and Volusia were the counties that were selected by Gore to request manual recounts. There were two factors that motivated the decision to select those counties. The first was that all of them had given Gore a reasonable margin of victory, and the second one was that they had a substantial number of uncounted votes that the machine count had rejected from which he could attempt to gather enough votes to overcome the relatively small lead that Bush had. For the next 33 days, the ticking clock would follow the parties like Captain Hook's crocodile. Under Florida law, the county election returns must be certified, or shall be certified, or may be certified. Those of you who followed it know that it was a matter of question at the time. But whatever it is, it's to happen by 5 p.m. the seventh day after the election. On November 13th, Secretary of State Katherine Harris announced that she would not extend the deadline. The manual recounts that were not received by that date would be ignored. The Volusia County Canvassing Board sued. The Supreme Court ruled that the deadline would, in fact, be extended to November 26th, but not until after two circuit court hearings and a Supreme Court argument. Gore had won a victory, but at a high price. 12 days were lost. 21 days remained until the December 12th deadline. Meanwhile, a separate drama was unfolding in Palm Beach County. The same day that Harris refused to extend the deadline, the status of a status conference was conducted before Judge LaBarga in Palm Beach County. One judge after another, before Judge LaBarga was placed in charge of the case, recused himself. And finally, with a courtroom full of lawyers, the chief judge announced that he had run through all of the judges in the circuit, and the only remaining judge was at lunch. And so all of us waited until Judge LaBarga returned from lunch and had the courage to agree to preside over what all other judges thought was a deadly job. He agreed to hear the case, and he dismissed it. And once he dismissed it, the case was immediately appealed to the Florida Supreme Court. By November 22nd, the Gore game plan was in trouble. Supreme Court, by the way, unanimously affirmed Judge LaBarga's decision. By November 22nd, the Gore game plan was in trouble. Bush had a 930-vote lead. Volusia County had completed its manual recount with little effect. Broward County was tipping for Gore, but not by enough to make up the difference. Gore was counting on Miami-Dade's 10,000 rejected ballots. But the Miami-Dade Canvassing Board had completed only 1% and was threatening to quit with Thanksgiving looming. The Gore lawyers went back and asked Judge LaBarga to order the Palm Beach County Canvassing Board to use a more lenient standard in an effort to cause more votes to be recounted in favor of Gore. Judge LaBarga refused, holding that the standard that had existed in Broward County for many years, which was to take into consideration all of the circumstances surrounding a given ballot, would continue to be the standard used. The board continued to use this relatively conservative standard. On November 23rd, the Miami-Dade Canvassing Board voted to stop counting. A petition was filed in the Third District Court of Appeal immediately. An emergency appeal went to the Florida Third District Court of Appeal affirmed unanimously. It went to the Florida Supreme Court, where the Florida Supreme Court denied the petition against Gore the same day. On November 24th, having failed to persuade the Palm Beach County Canvassing Board to use a more lenient standard, Gore's lawyer, David Boies, appeared before the Broward County Canvassing Board. and was more successful. He persuaded the Broward County Board to use a more liberal standard in which, if they found that there was any mark near or on a Chad, it would be counted. Any hanging, dimpled, marked Chad would be voted for whomever it would indicate. It was a Pyrrhic victory. 2 days later, Catherine Harris certified the results for Bush.
Florida, as follows. Governor George W. Bush, 2,912,790. Vice President Al Gore, 2,912,253.
This is a good time to talk about why compliance with the safe harbor provision was critical to Gore. By federal law, the same law passed by Congress after 1876, if different delegations are certified by state officials, Congress must choose which one is the one that would be seated, that would cast its ballots for a presidential candidate. Once Catherine Harris had certified the Bush delegation, which means that her certification went to Washington, the die was cast. It could not be uncertified. The best that Gore could hope for was that the Florida Supreme Court would order that a Gore delegation also be certified. It could not have ordered that a Gore delegation replace the Bush delegation. Both would go to Congress. Now we were back, or would have been back, in the same situation as existed in 1876, with one difference. The manner now, as of 2000, of resolving a conflict between two or more delegations is set forth in Title III, Section 15 of the United States Code, which was adopted to avoid the 1876 impasse. And it provides that both houses of Congress, each acting separately, must agree on which delegation would be seated. In 2001, both houses of Congress were controlled by Republicans. Even if by some miracle Gore had been able to get a majority in one house of Congress, he surely would never have gotten both. Congress would have deadlocked again. And what the law provides is that when the two houses cannot agree, the decision is made by the governor of the state. In 2000, as you know, that was Jeb Bush. And that explains why it was critical to Al Gore to meet the safe harbor provision and conclude all of the litigation by December 12th. That date was now only 16 days away. Having failed in his protest, Gore now filed the election contest in the Leon County Circuit Court. Was assigned to Judge Sanders Sauls, who held a pretrial conference the next day, November 28th. Here's a picture, by the way, of David Boies and me doing some synchronized dancing during the pretrial conference. The Gore lawyers asked Judge Sauls to order that the manual recount statewide begin immediately. Judge Sauls refused. Instead, he set a trial to begin on Saturday, December 2nd, the evening of which, you may recall, was the Winter Festival. The day before the trial, December 1st, the Florida Supreme Court affirmed Judge LaBarga's dismissal of the butterfly ballot case. Gore's opportunities were now dwindling. Judge Sauls conducted a two-day trial, Saturday and Sunday. One of the interesting aspects of it, one of the wonderful statements about this country, is that protesters stood on each side of the street before the courthouse all day, yelling back and forth, and then they adjourned to party for the Winter Festival that evening, only to return the next morning to regain their protests. Meanwhile, outside the courthouse, the circus atmosphere prevailed. On December 4th, Judge Sauls found for Bush. Gornad now had only 8 days remaining until the December 12th deadline. Immediately appealed to the District Court of Appeal, which immediately certified to the Supreme Court. Incidentally, the provision for a district court to certify to the Supreme Court is rarely used. In the 10 years prior to this, there had only been four instances in which the district court certified directly to the Supreme Court without hearing anything. It happened in this instance 37 times, the period of 36 days. On December 6th, two new cases were filed in Martin and Seminole counties challenging 25,000 absentee ballots. Bush led by over 1,000 votes in each of those counties. So a win in either of those cases by Gore would have made him president. There was no federal issue involved. There would have been no appeal to the federal courts. The cases were assigned to Judge Nikki Clark and Judge Terry Lewis. The Florida Supreme Court argument occurred on December 7th, which happened also to be my wife Allison and my anniversary. During the argument, Judge Pariente had this key exchange with Gore counsel David Boies.
Is the uniformity of how these manual recounts are conducted essential to the integrity of the process or also to the constitutionality of the statute?
Your Honor, I think it is important to the integrity of the process. I think if you had very wide variations, you could raise constitutional problems.
Well,
I would say that I think that it, for the reasons that you point out, it is quite important that this court be as specific as possible in terms of the standard to be applied so that we will have uniformity.
So, in response to Justice Pariente's question, David Boies said two things. First, he said if you had a wide variation resulting from different standards of manual recounts in different counties, you could have a constitutional problem. And second, for that reason, he urged the Supreme Court to not only order a recount statewide, but to set specific standards to be followed by the counties in conducting the recount. On December 8th, the Florida Supreme Court decided Bush v. Gore.
The majority of the court has reversed the decision of the trial court in part. It has further ordered that the Circuit Court of the Second Judicial Circuit here in Tallahassee shall immediately begin a manual recount of the approximately 9,000 Miami-Dade ballots that registered under votes. In addition, the Circuit Court shall enter orders ensuring the inclusion of the additional 215 legal votes for Vice President Gore in Palm Beach County and the 168 additional legal votes from Miami-Dade County. In addition, the Circuit Court shall order a manual recount of all undervotes in any Florida county where such a recount has not yet occurred. Because time is of the essence, the recount shall commence immediately.
With the exception of a slightly larger forehead, Craig Waters doesn't look a day older than he did when he made that statement. So, the court ordered a statewide recount, but it did not issue specific standards, as had been requested by Mr. Boies. The effect of the different standards is illustrated by the manual recounts in Broward and Palm Beach counties, and the difference in the number of machine-rejected ballots that were being recovered. Remember that Boies had persuaded Broward County to use a more liberal standard, but had failed to persuade Palm Beach to do the same. And here is the result. In Broward County, they recovered 12% of the machine-rejected ballots. In Palm Beach County, they recovered 0.02%. The difference was that Broward County was recovering 60 times the number of ballots as was being recovered by Palm Beach. If you got confused, I gave them to you backwards. But the graphics are still pretty. On December 12th, it all ended as quickly as it began. That morning, the Florida Supreme Court unanimously affirmed the Clark and Lewis decisions in Seminole and Martin County cases. That evening, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its opinion overturning the Florida Supreme Court's decision in Bush v. Gore. 7 of the 9 justices agreed that the recount mechanisms for Florida's manual recount did not satisfy minimum equal protection requirements. The problem, they said, was a lack of specific standards. By 5-4, the majority of the court refused to extend the December 12th deadline. That date, they said, is upon us. After 36 days, 48 cases, 76 judges, 147 hours of TV coverage, and lawyers too numerous to count, it was over. And when all was said and done, it wasn't lawyers or judges who made the difference. It was time.
Thank you, Barry. I would like to introduce Neil Skeen, who will be helping me moderate this evening. Neil is perhaps best known around Florida for his monthly column on state government for Florida Trend. He was the St. Petersburg Times bureau chief in Tallahassee in the 1980s, served on the Times editorial board, and then for 10 years was editor and president of Congressional Quarterly in Washington, D.C. Neil is the co-owner of Med Affinity Corporation, an electronic health records company, and is writing a history of the Florida Supreme Court for the Supreme Court Historical Society, and also has a T-shirt on that I actually haven't had time to read. Neil?
Hi. We dug out a shirt. I don't know if anybody can see it, but I think in the spirit of this that I think Barry should read the top 10 list on the back. This says Stop Electoral Dysfunction. I always thought it should say Electile Dysfunction.
I don't have very good control of my moderator, do I, because I have no idea what this says.
But I think, Barry, that if you'll read the top 10 list starting at the bottom,
like
these are the top 10 better ways to choose a president.
Number 10, presidential wrestle-off, 2000. Number 9, debates. No, that'll never work. Number 8, put candidates on an island, see who survives. Number 7, why I want to be president essay. Number 6, only one of them could have written it, probably.
How about this one?
Yeah, 6 is also a problem, spelling bee. 5, 50-yard dash. 4, thumb war. Now, that would have worked. 3, 1 potato, 2 potato, 2, paper, rock, and scissors, or 1, eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
All right, there you go. So. Well, I thought we might start by asking you to talk about the high degree of partisanship directed at the courts. And the view that both courts that ended up making the decision, the U.S. Supreme Court and the Florida Supreme Court, acted in partisan ways and let their partisan preferences simply determine the outcome.
I thought that was one of the most unfortunate parts of this whole thing. When it was over, different interested sides accused both courts of not only being partisan but being corrupt, which was the term that was actually used to define both courts. I was disturbed to see that more lawyers who had been involved didn't stand up to defend them. I wrote a column in a University of Florida. Sorry, they asked me to do it. So University of Florida, a journal that was titled In Defense of Two Supreme Courts, because the fact is that both Supreme Courts, I think, acted honorably and in accordance with precedent. I know that there were many, many people were accusing the Florida Supreme Court of acting politically. But as I noted, the Florida Supreme Court affirmed unanimously 5 decisions that were in favor of Bush. 2 of those decisions, the Martin and Seminole County cases, they knew at the time would have made Al Gore president. So as far as the Florida Supreme Court is concerned, it was unfair to accuse them of partisanship. As far as the U.S. Supreme Court was concerned, you saw the essence of the issue tonight. David Boies, Gore's lawyer, conceded that the lack of standards would result, or he said would probably result, in a serious constitutional problem, and the result of standards was significant. So you can go into a lot more detail to defend either court. And by the way, the courts never clashed. They made their decisions based upon different legal issues. But I think both of them acted honorably, and they deserve to be recognized for that.
Let me ask you about one other thing. You had, by what I'm told was the Greenberg-Traurig count, 2,753 TV appearances and 1,141 print references. How did you get into this in the first place?
I'll tell you how I got into it, but first I'll tell you that about 2 weeks after it was over, my son Jonathan, who was here this evening and was at the time 2 years old, pointed at the TV and said, "Turn Daddy on." So, and I said, "Mommy always does." But I got into it because I don't want to give you too long a story, but I ran for attorney general and was thoroughly defeated by Jim Smith, who at the time was a Democrat. He later became a Republican, and because he and I were relatively civil in our race with each other, when he had problems, he hired me to represent him. Then when Jeb Bush needed a lawyer in a battle that he had during his campaign, Jim Smith, who was working, his staff was working for Jeb, suggested that Jeb retain me. I represented Jeb a number of times, and then when his brother got in trouble, he asked Jeb, and one of the curious things was a statement that was made by a client of mine once who was a member of the Republican state executive committee and sued the Republican Party and was asked why he hired a Democrat, and he said, "When I hire brain surgeons and lawyers, I don't ask for their party affiliation." So nobody ever asked what my party affiliation was, and that's how I got involved.
Dexter Douglas, by the way, can't join us. His wife's had surgery in Jacksonville and is not being released till tomorrow, and certainly has asked forgiveness for that. Dexter was sort of, I guess you would say, the leading local lawyer on the Gore side of that case, and wasn't as visible as you were. But it's interesting. John Newton is here. How many others of you were involved? Any of the lawyers involved in this? I'm seeing a couple of hands.
Yeah, I want to recognize my partner, Sean Frazier, who at the time was an associate and did all of the work that I got the credit for.
You told me once an interesting story about who would argue at the Supreme Court, and it was not going to be you. And at the conclusion of the argument, you finally got an agreement that you would get 5 minutes as the local counsel. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, that was the first Florida Supreme Court argument.
Right. And was it Ben? Who argued instead?
Carvin.
Carvin argued instead, and I think used up all of the time. And then what happened?
The background was that I had been arguing the cases and that the media had been billing this as a Boies, Richard battle, and Saturday night I told my wife that they weren't going to let me argue it, and she said, "Well, that's crazy. Why not?" I said, "Because the people who are going to make the decision are political, and they see me as a potential threat if they give me enough of a platform, and then I'll run for office later." That's the truth. I'd already run for office and been defeated and didn't want to do it again, but they didn't know that. So, in fact, Sunday morning they came over and told me they decided to let Carvin make the argument. And Carvin was with Sean, was up all night, was red-eyed because they also told him the last minute. And it was to be 2 o'clock Monday morning, and Monday I was crossing the street, and I thought, you know, I'm not going to give this up so easily. So I sat down with Carvin, and I said, "Look, this doesn't make any sense.
you should at least give me 5 minutes. I've been the one who worked in this case from the beginning. This is my state. And he said, well, let me talk to the political guys. And 45 minutes later, they agreed that they would give me 5 minutes. And I sat on the side of the rostrum and watched the clock wind down to zero and thought, well, there you go. My moment in the sun is gone. And then I heard Chief Justice Wells say to the marshal, Mr. Marshall, Mr. Richards still has his 5 minutes, doesn't he? And the marshal said, yes, sir. And I was back on my feet.
Right, so we're going to go ahead and bring other panelists up now. I would like to introduce to you Ion Sancho as Leon County Election Supervisor, if you want to move towards the front while I do your bio. Ion has devoted special attention to studying voting technologies and increasing citizen participation in our electoral system. He was appointed to the Florida Supreme by the Florida Supreme Court in December of 2000 as the technical expert to oversee the Florida recount effort. In 2005, Mr. Sancho sanctioned the first test of voting machines by voting integrity experts captured on the film Hacking Democracy. Ion.
He's a closet French author.
Actually, most people don't know that Spanish people in the Basque region develop berets, and that's where my family comes from.
All I know is this is a guy confident of re-election next time. That's you can tell. I want to ask you to go back 10 years. You're the election supervisor. You're a well-regarded election supervisor, and you wake up and find what's going on. What are you thinking?
Disaster. Because I have been elected about 10 years earlier, in 1989, and I came in sort of as an outsider to the elections process. And what I found was most of the people that were serving in supervisor of elections around the state had basically grown up in that office. And supervisors, as they retired, somebody else on their staff took over. And basically, it was sort of like a tiny backwater of the political world. I doubt if 99% of the citizens of the state of Florida knew the name of their supervisor of elections. And I would say most citizens labored under the belief that their votes were always counted in an election. And as a practitioner who studied the field, I knew immediately that we were going to have a problem, because in my journeys in visiting different jurisdictions, I saw disaster after disaster after disaster. No one seemed in the state to really grasp that all voters' votes should be counted whenever possible. And so different counties were using technologies that didn't do that. For example, we were all stunned when we heard about the 29,000 or 27,000 overvotes that happened in Palm Beach. Well, it wasn't stunning to me, because I knew that in 1996, in the previous presidential election, Palm Beach County had thrown out 15,000 voters' votes and had not notified any of them that their votes had not been counted in the 1996 presidential election. And I knew that across the state routinely, tens of thousands of votes possibly weren't being counted by the kinds of technologies that were being used. And now we were supposed to try to accurately count all the votes. I knew it was going to be a disaster. A disaster.
Now, just to get the glossary, an overvote is when a voter votes for two people in the same race. Is that correct? Or the card shows.
Or the machine tabulating reads two votes where it should only see one mark. That's an overvote. The machine is programmed to read only one mark in a race, and it doesn't see one mark. It sees multiple marks.
And when it sees that, it throws the vote out.
No. If you were in a central count optical scan jurisdiction, like, for example, Polk, you would lose your right to have a vote legally counted in that race, and all your other votes would be tabulated. That vote was never outsourced. Basically, it was lost, and that's what's been going on for decades in the state of Florida, particularly on these central count systems. It is only rejected in a precinct count machine, which is what Leon County adopted in 92.
And just to finish the glossary, an undervote is when you, in fact, don't vote. There's no vote shown in the race, right?
Or the machine cannot see a vote properly marked in the area that has been programmed to look. That's an undervote.
Now, what's the first election supervisor kind of problem that you saw?
Well, the very first problem was that the supervisor of elections from Alachua County, who used the same kind of system that we did in Leon County, actually had the temerity to call the Secretary of State's office and ask the Secretary of State what standards to use on the machine recount, which was scheduled for the next day, an automatic machine recount. And a number of us that were using the same kind of technology were wondering, well, what are the standards that the Secretary of State will implement? We got in short order the answer, none. We will not issue standards from the Secretary of State's office on how you're to conduct the automatic machine recount.
And we've got a question. Has anything improved since 2000? Could this happen again? And if nothing's improved, why can't we all have the same voting machines and methods?
Well, it's a good question, and tremendous technological changes have occurred. All central count optical scan systems were banned in 2001. And, again, I know most of the television reporters tended to focus on the Chad. Actually, those systems had anywhere between a 6 to 8% error, Duval having the highest. But the central count optical scan systems all produced far greater errors, all of them. And these were systems designed whose ballot layout had been done by the ES&S Corporation out of Omaha, Nebraska. They had never even seen some of the voting systems that had been used. They made the ballot mock-up off of a template that the Secretary of State had used for lever voting machines. So this company designed a lever voting machine-looking ballot and modified it for a precinct count optical scan, and there were huge problems, such as in this the presidential race, which listed 10 names in bottom part of column one, actually 8 names because there were 10 candidates. The top 2 presidential candidates were all listed on the top of column 2 without any statement on the top of column 2 that this is a continuation of columns 1's presidential choices. And that ballot ranged from a disenfranchisement in Gadsden County of 12.4% to about 6% in some of other rural counties. And a political scientist took that ballot to at Ohio State University Rotary Club and presented it to the Rotary Club, and 10% of the Rotary marked it incorrect as well. So there were a number of really technological and ballot design problems which would, in fact, disenfranchise voters.
I'd like for you to just say one word as our bridge to the next panelist about the punch card ballot and the butterfly pattern in Palm Beach County.
Well, I think the butterfly ballot speaks for itself. It was a well-intentioned disaster. It was well-intentioned because the supervisor of elections there wanted to make a larger type size so that the elderly voters could read it. But they were using a really early model of the punch card voting system that was developed in the very early 70s, never upgraded at all. And in fact, you couldn't adjust the typeface without changing how you were presenting the order of the candidates. And they developed this butterfly ballot so that they could have the larger typeface with no human studies as to what this checkerboard pattern would do to voters.
Okay, and that is a good segue. I am honored to introduce a speaker who knows a lot about the butterfly ballot, Justice Jorge Labarca, who I actually haven't met yet. Governor Lawton Childs appointed Justice LaBarga to the Circuit Court of the 15th Judicial Circuit in and for Palm Beach County in 1996. In that capacity, he served in the Family, Civil, and Criminal Divisions. He also serves as an administrative judge of the Civil Division. Justice LaBarga was appointed by Governor Crist, some bipartisanship there, to a Democratic appointment and a Republican appointment, to the Florida Supreme Court, where he presently sits on as the 84th justice to take office at the Florida Supreme Court since statehood was granted in 1845. Justice LaBarga was born in Cuba in 1952. Welcome.
Did you have to say the year?
1970.
Thank you. Thank you. This whole thing brings back nightmares. I'm going to have to go back to my therapist again. Election day, when this whole thing came about, I recall that we were hearing in the Palm Beach County Courthouse that motions were being filed and lawsuits were being filed, and all the judges in the Civil Division, and I was the chief of the Civil Division at the time, we were just having nightmares that we would get the case. So the next morning when we came, we learned that Judge Catherine Brunson had drawn the case. And I recall going to lunch that day with two other judges, and that's the lunch that Barry was talking about. And while we're lunch, we were kind of celebrating the fact that we didn't get the case. So when we came back, if you ever been to Palm Beach County, the taxpayers of Palm Beach County spent $180 million on this beautiful courthouse near the Intracoastal with the most gorgeous view you can find. And to get into the courthouse, for me to get to the private elevators that the judges have, I had to walk through the cafeteria. And the way the courthouse was set up, we had one courtroom, I believe it was on the third floor, that was wired directly down to a section of the cafeteria. And what we would do is we set up a big screen television, and the reporters would sit down there and watch the proceedings at a table and so they could be comfortable and away from the courtroom. So we're walking through on my way back, again thinking that we beat this one. And as I looked at the big screen television set, I saw Wally Colbath, our chief judge, on CNN. And I mentioned to the other two judges, why is Wally on CNN? And then I hear the most terrible words, I think. I heard, there he is. And within 5 seconds, I had 20 microphones about this close to me, asking me if I was going to grant a new election, where I was going to do this, do that, and I'm saying, what's going on? Well, you don't know. You're the next judge. And there's a door that we had to get through, and I had to swipe my ID card to the slot for the door to open, and I couldn't get my key. And so one of the other judges grabbed my card, slid the thing, and pulled me in, and I got up to the to my office, and my judicial assistant said, the chief judge wants to see you and Judge McCarthy, one of the other judges with me. And so we went up to the chief judge's office, and the chief judge says, well, LaBarga, you're it. And if you punt, McCarthy here has it. So what are you going to do? Well, I never realized how good of a Catholic McCarthy was until the time it took me to say, I'm going to keep the case, I think he had already gone through an entire rosary. And those fingers were going through the beads like turbocharged, you know. So I remember that the chief judge then handed me a file full of motions that Barry and other lawyers had filed and said, go to it. And so I took the bench, I walked in, and it was like a scene from something you've never seen. And I recall I looked up, and I think at that hearing you were appearing by phone. You were here in Tallahassee, I believe. And I looked up and I said, is there something you lawyers want me to hear? And there it went. So that's how that lunch situation took place. But, you know, I just hearing about it. But I'll say this, the happiest day in my life next to the day when I married my wonderful wife was when I saw that yellow Ryder truck heading north on the turnpike to wonderful, beautiful Tallahassee. And I believe it was Nikki Clark's and Terry Lewis's worst nightmare.
Justice LaBerge, I have a question from the audience. Did you have any trouble with your butterfly ballot?
You know, when I went to vote, I remember where I vote is a church near my house. I actually walked there. And I remember walking back, and a couple of my neighbors were standing in front. And one of them, you know, Kevin, said, did you vote? I said, yes. Did you have any problems? I said, I didn't see any. And he said, it was kind of weird, and I caught it when I went back. And I had to go back and get another card and try again because I thought I voted for the wrong person. And I said, well, I didn't catch it. So, well, I know I voted for the wrong person.
I would just like to ask maybe both of you. Go ahead, Barry.
Some of you may be wondering, having seen what happened in Palm Beach County, how Judge LaBerge dismissed the case. And I'm going to defend him since I'm going to have to appear before him again one of these days. The United States Constitution provides that all states have to vote for president on the same day. So there was no solution. It was everybody acknowledged, including the candidates, that it was a mistake, but there was no way to fix it at this point, and that's why Judge LaBerge dismissed it.
Well, in fact, you had sort of a famous line to the lawyers. You gave them an assignment before the next hearing to find you a case.
Right. Yeah, I basically said, find me a case that says I can give you a new election, something.
I think it said any time since 1776.
Yeah, and you know, but there was one, and I believe it was, if I recall, it was United States versus Love. It was a senatorial race, I think, out of Louisiana, that has some language that I found helpful in making that decision.
I'd just like maybe the three of you here, before we move on to the next panelist, to what extent was the butterfly ballot really the pivotal thing that changed the outcome of this election? There were, what, thousands of butterfly votes. Barry showed the numbers for Buchanan. What do you think?
Well, there's one factor in this race that people overlook. It wasn't just Buchanan taking those 55,000 votes or whatever. There was also somebody else in this race that people forget about, and that was Ralph Nader. And he took a chunk of votes away from Al Gore in that race. And I know right after the election, I was often asked to speak at various groups. And if you know Palm Beach County, the political dynamics of Palm Beach County is mostly condominiums, and they're mostly Democrats. And they were very angry that Al Gore did not win. So anywhere I went, I faced this fiery group. And I kept telling them, I said, but, you know, if you want to blame somebody, you might want to look at Ralph Nader. If he had not been there, I think things might have been different.
And why was there not a judicial remedy to the problem that Ian was describing with the ballots and the ultimate confusion in practice, whatever may have been true in theory?
Well, I mean, if you look at the way the candidacy board, the way I looked at it, the candidacy board are composed of three people. You have the chair of the county commission elected. You have a county court judge elected. And you have the supervisor of elections elected. So you got three people who are directly accountable to the voters. And I saw the candidacy board as the jury. And they were to make the factual determination as to what the intent of the voter was in those things. So I left it to them. And I think that's the only way a at least in my opinion, you could do it. Now, Palm Beach County, you may recall we had an election about this time last week, and you may recall that the governor's election was very tight. And which county was it that we had to wait for until about 2 in the morning? You got to love them. It's Palm Beach County again. So we seem to be having, we've had, since Teresa Lepore, who, by the way, worked at that office since high school. She was like an intern in high school, and that's where she started. And she was just excellent. And you walk into that office, and she was a wealth of knowledge. And it's a shame that this happened to her, because she was a very fine, dedicated public servant. But since Teresa, we had two supervisors of election. One was defeated by the present one on allegations of the same thing that happened to this new one last Tuesday night. So now she's under fire. I read the local papers every day on my computer for the same thing.
Hard job.
It's a tough job. I would not want your job.
I am now going to bring up two more panelists. It's my pleasure to introduce both Judge Nikki Clark and Judge Terry Lewis. Appointed to the First District Court of Appeals by Florida Governor Charlie Crist, Nikki Clark previously served as a circuit judge, Second Judicial Circuit of Florida, appointed by Governor Lawton Chiles. Judge Clark presided in felony, civil, family, and juvenile divisions. Judge Terry Lewis has served as a judge since 1989, following 10 years in private practice of law. He is also an adjunct professor at the FSU College of Law. He is a member of Leadership Tallahassee and Leadership Florida. They both have really long bios that I'm not going to do so they can talk. Judge Lewis and Judge Clark.
Thank you. Where do we start?
Well, let me ask. I'll tell you what, I'm going to ask Terry first because he's first in time. You got the first case. Did you make the mistake of going to lunch? Is that how you got this case?
No.
You were there doing your duty and still got the case. So the first case comes to you. Tell us just a little about that first case and, you know, what happened to you personally as you suddenly became the center of for your 15 minutes of fame, which stretched on and on for 37 days.
Well, let me first say that I don't know about you, but I think Barry Richard did a great job of summarizing the whole election contest from the beginning to the end. I learned a lot of stuff I didn't know before. And to continue with that theme, to show you how much I didn't know, the night of the election, the Tallahassee Bar Association met, and I remember Marshall Cassidy Sr., who used to be the executive director of the Florida Bar, came to me and said, you know, Terry, this election, I tell you, it's going to be close. I don't think we're going to know who the president is until at least sometime tomorrow. I went, Marshall. It's probably going to be close, but these machines, they're accurate, and they'll count it up, and we'll know who won at the regular time. It's no, that was the first of my predictions that didn't come true, all the way up to, I don't think the U.S. Supreme Court is going to get involved in this. This is a state matter. So at any rate, no, it don't. Yeah, so I, you know, where's Justice LaVarga? Yeah, and so I said, no, that's that butterfly stuff down in Palm Beach. There, those guys are going to take care of that.
If you could hold the mic up just a little bit. Thank you.
I was doing a case. Let me take you down memory lane. I was doing a case on a couple of family members who were fighting over who should have ownership and possession of a house on McCaskill Avenue here in Tallahassee. And I saw one of the court administrators back in the back trying to get my attention. I said, okay. And we took a break, and he said, he handed me the Volusia County petition asking to tell Catherine Harris to let them recount, which is what they wanted to do. And so I said, okay, set it for a hearing this afternoon, and we'll see what happens.
And who showed up?
Well, it wasn't that many people. I forget now. I know that John Sherstrom, who is now circuit judge, was one of the lawyers for Catherine Harris. I remember that. Clay Roberts, who is now in the First District Court of Appeal, was an attorney for Catherine Harris. At some point, I know Dexter Douglas came in. And Barry, were you there on that first thing? I don't know if you were or not. Yeah, I don't actually remember.
And when did you get the sense that this was going to be a big deal for you?
Well, not to be flip or anything, but it was another case. I knew it was important, and the only thing that really was significant is I knew there were a lot of people watching, that this was of interest to people other than the litigants. Contrary to the case that was in front of me when this first came, nobody else cared about McCaskill Avenue. They did about Pennsylvania Avenue. But we're in Florida. We are, as you know, more open court. A lot of the reporters and folks from the news media that came here were just surprised and delighted that they could get access, that they could have cameras in the courtrooms and things like that. So we're a little bit more used to that sort of media attention to cases in Tallahassee because we're the state capital and we get cases that are of interest around the state.
Judge Clark, but you came in close to the end in all of this process, and so you kind of knew the attention that was coming at you.
I didn't know the attention that was coming at me, though.
What
in
happened?
In fact, those first 2 weeks or so, I wasn't involved at all. We had a couple of minor cases. There were dozens of cases filed here. Most didn't get any media attention, so weren't considered to be big deal cases. And in fact, most of them were relatively minor. I actually went to Detroit for Thanksgiving. I have sisters there. And as I was watching, of course, the whole country was watching what was going on. And I told my sisters, I may be a little bit busy next week. And when I came back was when I first got that Seminole County case. In fact, I got a series of two or three cases on the day I came back. And one of those was the Seminole County case. I'm not nearly as laid back as Terry is. And I kind of knew right away that this was a big deal case. In fact, as soon as I got the case, my judicial assistant, Doris, who's here, came and told me that I had the case. In fact, I had planned to go to Amelia Island for a judicial conference. In fact, I was speaking at that judicial conference. But as things got closer, I called them and told them, I'm not going to be there. I think I'm going to be a little busy in Tallahassee. And when that case first happened, when I first got that case, the first thing we had to do was to schedule a conference right away, you know, within 24 hours. And once we scheduled that conference, of course, things were just crazier and crazier, and there were hundreds of reporters here, and everything was just frenetic, just at a frenetic pace. And as I walked into the courtroom, I thought to myself, you know what, this is a big deal. And I was nervous at first. I thought, oh, my God, what if I get in there and I start speaking German or something? And my bailiff said, well, Judge Clark, do you speak German? And I said, no, that's a problem. So I was really nervous before I went in. But as soon as I went in, I felt a sense of calmness come over me. Because I realized then that I didn't create this predicament. I can't solve a social issue. I can't solve a political issue. And that I had to address this case just like any other case that had been assigned to me. There were laws to look at. There were facts to get developed. There were rules of procedure. There were rules of evidence. So once I came to the realization that really, from my vantage point, it's just another case, then we were able to proceed and get the case done and get the evidence in and abide by all the rules and get moving.
I'd like to ask both you and Barry to address this, because at one point the Bush side wanted to disqualify you from the case. What'd you think about that?
Well, you know, I haven't thought about that for about 10 years.
We already know what LaVarga would have done.
I haven't thought about that for 10 years. When I looked at my notes last night, I kind of, in preparation for this, I took out a couple of notebooks full of notes I had and some articles and whatnot. And I still think somebody owes me an apology. I mean, there were some very harsh words said. There were some very harsh allegations. But as a judge, when a judge receives a motion to disqualify her, there's only one thing that judge can do. The judge can't react to it, or she's off. The judge can't deny the allegations, or she's off. The judge can't comment at all. The only one thing I could do was to look at the motion and make a determination of whether or not it was legally sufficient. I look at the motion, and it was a fairly lengthy motion, and determine without much deliberation that it simply wasn't legally sufficient. I wrote a two-line order declaring that it was not legally sufficient and moved on with the case. Now, there had been requests after that that I stay my order to move on with the case so that the DCA could take a look at it. And my reaction was, well, no, I'm not going to stay there. Does it seem like I made a mistake on that? I mean, does it seem like I'm uncertain on my ruling? And I stood by my order and denied the motion to disqualify, and we went out and had hearings. As we continued with our hearings, the District Court of Appeal took that issue up. And it took about 2 days to get that ruling back, where they affirmed me and my decision to not disqualify myself.
When the case was assigned to Judge Clark, the Bush people involved were extremely upset for two reasons. One is that she fell into the two demographic groups that were the worst for Bush. And the second one was that shortly before that, she had been passed over by Jeb Bush for elevation to the District Court of Appeal. So
the most public rejection in the history of America.
Well, she was their worst nightmare, and we had a lengthy argument where they wanted me to sign the motion to recuse, and I refused to do it because I said that I didn't think that the motion stated a basis for recusal, number one, and number two, I thought she was a fine judge and would be completely impartial. And if you look back, they got somebody else to sign it. If you look back at the records, it is the only document filed on behalf of Bush in 48 cases that does not bear my signature, and I'm proud of that. And of course, she did exactly what I told him she would do, is she ruled the appropriate way. And before I put the mic down, I'd like to remind Judge Lewis of another case that he may recall, which was 2 weeks before the election and could have changed the result of the election. There was a lawsuit filed challenging the fact that Jeb Bush had sent a letter to registered Republicans urging them to fill out an enclosed application for an absentee ballot. And the letter had a watermark which purported to be the seal of the state of Florida. It is unlawful in Florida to use the seal for political purposes, and the lawsuit was seeking to have an order that all of the absentee ballots that were returned in response to that were illegal. Now, the result of that would have been that Gore would have been elected because the Secretary of State's office said it was too late to get them more absentee ballots. Judge Lewis, I had two grounds. He ruled for me on the first ground, which was that statute had no private right of action. It didn't allow private individuals to file an action to enforce it. So I never had to go to the second ground, which I doubt that he was ever aware of, which was this. The seal on the letter was taken by the printer from a picture of the Florida state flag. But what the printer didn't know is that the great seal of the state of Florida had been changed years before, but it had never been changed on the flag. So actually, that was not the seal of the state of Florida. And I was ready to make that argument if you ruled against me on the first one.
You're listening to a special delayed broadcast of From the Village Square, the Florida recount plus 10 years on WFSU-FM 88.9 Tallahassee.
We've got a question for Judge Clark. If you can answer this very briefly, I know it's a really good story, but we need to move on to our final panelist. Jesse Jackson came to your court. What was your thought when you saw him?
I've been asked that over the years, and quite frankly, that story was a lot less about Jesse Jackson than about me being at work. We were in courtroom 3D, which is a fairly small courtroom. We've got great big courtrooms now, not the Taj Mahal. But we were in 3D, which has a capacity for about 60 people. We had at least 70 people in there. It was hot. It was busy. And as you can imagine, I had to listen to every single word that was being presented to me. As you can also imagine, America was observing my court and seeing what was going on. But I was not the observer to see, wow, who's here? Wow, guess who's here? I wasn't the observer. I was at work. I was doing my job. I needed to listen to people. So at any point there was any commotion, I would lean over to my bailiff and tell them, they got to cut that out. They've got to either be quiet or leave. Well, at one point there was some commotion in the back with five or six people talking. Again, I'm at work. I got to be able to hear. And I leaned over and told my bailiff, get him out. I don't know who it is. Get him out. They're too noisy. So the bailiff walked over and did whatever bailiffs do. And he walked back and said, it's fine. It was Jesse Jackson. So the story really wasn't that I put Jesse Jackson out of my courtroom. It really was that I needed as much quiet as possible to get my work done. And he and his entourage were just a little bit too busy.
We saved the biggest story for last, and now I would like to introduce our final panelists, both from the Florida Supreme Court, retired Justice Harry Lee Anstead and Public Information Officer Craig Waters. My apologies to the live streamers who now have to move back and forth. And former Justice Anstead was raised as the youngest of six children by his mother in Jacksonville's Brentwood Housing District. Just after the Great Depression, he began work at a young age, cutting lawns, moving furniture, doing anything to help support his family and himself, and ultimately built a future career as a lawyer and a public servant. Justice Anstead advanced to the highest judicial office in the state government July 1, 2002, when he became Florida's 50th Chief Justice. Craig Waters. Craig is best known as the spokesman for the Florida Supreme Court in the recount. He established the court's public information office. Before his role with the court, he worked with as staff attorney with Justice Kogan and Justice Barquette. He's the author of several books and award-winning journalist as well. Neil has a question. Neil?
I was just going to ask, I'll start with Justice Anstead. I'd like to know when you guys saw this coming.
I think all seven justices on the court really were just like other citizens in the state of Florida or in Leon County or in the country, okay, that I can still remember sitting up late at night in bed with my wife watching the election returns and probably sometime the wee hours of the morning turning off the television with all of the major commercial channels having announced or projected that Vice President Gore had carried Florida. So the remaining few hours from the middle of the night, I slept peacefully, certainly not contemplating that there would be multiple election challenges in the state of Florida.
I actually was at an educational conference where I was giving a presentation on how to use the World Wide Web to distribute court documents to the public and the press, which was a novel concept at the time. I didn't realize I was going to have a homework assignment from my own educational program when I got back to Tallahassee. I went to bed the evening of the election. I began to see the returns coming in. I had an early morning meeting at the conference the next day, and I said, if I stay up, I'm not going to sleep. So I turned on pay-per-view. I watched Gladiator. Good preparation. And so I didn't know anything about the election until I got up the next morning, and I turned on one of the cable news networks, and they were showing just this massive confusion, and they were talking about everything was haywire in Florida. So I went down to the hotel desk to see if I could find out some more, and they had a stack of four different versions of the Orlando Sentinel. The first one said Gore wins. The second one said too close to call. The third one said Bush wins. And the fourth one said something like we're confused. And so shortly after I got back to my hotel room, I had a call from the Chief Justice telling me that I really needed to get back to Tallahassee right away. And so it was that same day, the day after the election, that I began to realize that we were facing a news story of the first magnitude. And I began to get us as prepared as I possibly could. I actually put together the website that we would use to distribute documents to the world and the press that same week, because I wanted to be as ready as I possibly could. And I sat down with the Chief Justice at the time, and we began working out the details of how we were going to deal with a worst-case scenario. He was telling me at the time, oh, it's in federal court, it'll stay there, don't worry about it. And I wasn't so sure. And sure enough, by the next week, we were starting to get some filings at our court and some action.
Justice Anstey, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that happened to us, unlike the individual judges, you know, that are up here that perhaps only had to preside over one case or one dispute, like Justice LaVarga, really got off easy here. But at some point we realized, of course, that these petitions to our court, either coming directly from the trial courts or being passed through the district courts of appeal, were coming fast and furious. And so, of course, we had to consider multiple challenges, both individually and in individual counties, and also statewide. So you might wonder, you know, how could the court possibly handle all these things coming in a relatively short period of time? Well, it's interesting because probably the thing that all seven justices would agree on, that the less fortunate side of our work is the fact that we have to consider all of the death penalty appeals in the state of Florida. And in most instances, we have to consider them a number of times. But one of the things that happens is that when the governor actually signs a death warrant, we go into a crisis mode because, in effect, the Florida Supreme Court is the last real appeal, okay, before a person might be executed. And it really was that model of going into a crisis mode that we had already developed to the nth degree as far as the procedures that we would follow, the information that we needed to decide the case, setting up oral arguments when appropriate. So it turned out that there was a silver lining with reference to our hearing the last-minute death appeals after a warrant was issued, because we already had a crisis mode procedure where we could react really very quickly insofar as getting all the appropriate information, deciding whether or not we needed the parties and the lawyers to come to the court for an oral argument session, or whether or not we could dispose of the case without having them come for oral argument. So that is the crisis mode that we developed in order to handle this. Now there's a little kicker to this, is that of course we were in crisis mode during this entire period of time. Well, one of the favors that Governor Bush did for us during that period of time was to sign two death warrants. Of course, we didn't have much to do, and we were eager, you know, for the new business. In addition to that, the Chief Justice decided that we really should not let the influx of these cases disturb our regular schedule. So although a lot of people didn't pay attention to it, we went forward with our regular oral argument schedule in early December, in which we have something like two dozen very important appeals to prepare for and decide also. So there were some internal dynamics, going on within the court that I thought were interesting, but that nobody seemed to pay too much attention to.
I have to say, I went back and looked, actually, at the decisions that came out in November of 2000, and I was actually impressed with the number of sometimes seemingly innocuous cases. I think there was a divorce property settlement case that came out. It was those kinds of things coming along in addition to the death cases. I wonder, what everybody saw was the oral argument. So Barry's there, David Boies is there, the various lawyers arguing. What they didn't see was what happened when you walked down through the little curtain down the steps. And did you tend to write separately? Did you have conferences together, the seven of you? How did those decisions get reached?
Well, first you have to understand the machine. Just as soon as we actually have something that we know that we're probably going to have to decide, that is that we have a wonderful staff of lawyers that are there intentionally to make sure that we have an adequate and objective record of whatever the case proceedings might be, and also that do extensive legal research into the issues that are presented in the particular cases, so that well before we actually go out on the bench to hear the oral presentations of the lawyers, we have been thoroughly briefed as to the facts of the case and the controlling law. Okay. Some cases, and really Justice LaVarga's decision, were, in hindsight, relatively easy, okay, because it addresses the potential remedy. That is, what do you do, even though everybody might agree that the butterfly ballot that you saw displayed earlier in Barry's presentation, who in their right mind, would put something like that up, for the voters. But the idea is, well, what's the remedy? And as was pointed out, there's a constitutional provision that they have to vote on the same day, so you could hardly have a separate special election with another ballot after the fact. It just doesn't work. And so there were several other cases in terms of the remedy that we addressed in that way. I recall one case, for instance, where it was demonstrated that a number of Republican supervisor of elections actually took absentee ballots that had been filed by Republican registered voters, but that were incomplete or in error in some way. And in those offices, they took it upon themselves to either complete them or to fix those errors, but only for the Republican absentee ballots. If it was a Democratic absentee ballot, they just threw them out because they weren't complete. As it's been pointed out, to be sure we're on a bipartisan level here, Teresa Lepore in Palm Beach County, where this butterfly ballot was, is a Democrat. Is that correct, Justice LaVarga? And, so it was a Democrat supervisor of election, that designed that. And so there were a number of cases where we didn't have oral argument because we felt that we could resolve that in a pretty straightforward manner. The two cases that we had oral argument on, however, presented much, much more serious issues. And perhaps the first one is a good one to illustrate that, because there was indeed a statutory provision that said that the supervisor of elections in each county had to certify the results to the Secretary of State's elections division by a certain date. Okay? And so the Catherine Harris was arguing, well, that was an absolute, regardless of whether there should be a recount, which would extend that potentially that date. But we could see that although it was candidates, for instance, that may have been the direct parties challenging, that you had a serious underlying issue there of the rights of the voters, the right to franchise, and that is, my goodness, potentially could Catherine Harris reject a recount or reject the certification by a supervisor of elections that came after that date and therefore throw out citizens' votes as a result of that date, you know, being in the statutory scheme. Well, so that was the kind of issue in that first case that we were looking at.
Well, let me just jump in, because one of the things that got a lot of criticism about partisanship on the court, I think that was Judge Lewis's case, that the, y'all tell me if I'm wrong, that the Gore people did not appeal, but the court on its own motion then entered an order that Craig had to summarize it. You can summarize it, but basically overturned his ruling or stayed his ruling on your own motion. How did that happen?
Well, I'm not exactly. I think probably you're referring to the fact that whereas the actual appeal that we had in the second case that we had oral argument on just involved an attempt at a recount in a limited number of counties. That is that the Gore people were saying we just want a recount in a limited number of counties. Up in Barry's presentation, you could see some of the demographics of why certain counties were picked out by Vice President Gore. It's pretty obvious he was going to go back to counties that were overwhelmingly Democrat or overwhelmingly had voted, you know, in his favor. But on the other side, really the argument that was being made really was covered in Ian Sancho's remarks, and that is that there was something generically wrong with these punch card ballots. And so one of the concerns that we had was that, well, wait a minute, if there's something generically wrong, Mr. Sancho referred to the fact that the sort of accepted margin of error was like 6 to 8% in those and my goodness, 6 to 8% in the certainly at least the hundreds of thousands of votes that were cast by that method, okay, would end up being a very sizable number. If those punch card ballots were being used in other counties, in addition to the counties that Gore had picked out to ask for a recount, it would hardly be fair to the citizens of Florida or to the other candidate, Mr. Bush, not to include other counties where the voter registration or the vote, whatever, was initially in favor of Mr. Bush. In those particular, if there was a problem, in other words, generically with the punch card, then those had to be reexamined wherever they were used in the state of Florida. Otherwise, the idea of overseeing the statewide election would be meaningless.
Let me just ask Craig one quick question. So how did you end up being the face of the Supreme Court for all of these weeks? How did that come about? Most courts don't even have a press spokesman.
Well, I was already the press spokesman, but I can tell you it came about because of really bad luck. The marshal at our court saw what was going on at Catherine Harris's office across the street.
which had become chaotic. At one point, they threw the press out of the building, infuriating the press, and it just the whole scene got very out of hand. And as a result of that, our marshal, who was a retired full colonel from the Army and acted accordingly, locked down our entire building. And I went into the Chief Justice and I said, I don't think this looks good. It doesn't look like we're being transparent. It's going to be used against us. There will be unfavorable stories. I really oppose it. And he said, I'm not willing to countermand our marshal. Why don't you just go out and talk to the press? That's how it started. And in the beginning, it really was relatively simple. I was simply going out. There would be a few reporters out there. We would talk. Very often I would give one interview after another after another. At that point, I could still do a few in a row. But as events progressed, and I can tell you that the one event that really pushed me into the limelight in a way that I did not anticipate was what happened on November the 17th. When the court did order Catherine Harris not to certify the election. And at that point in time, I had reporters just running across the street, gathering around me. We had to bring out the podium because there were so many microphones, they couldn't reach me. Have you ever seen these booms that the reporters use? They have these big, long, puffy things on the end. I had these things hovering, several of them, hovering 4 inches from my nose. And while I'm trying to talk to TV cameras and to a live audience, and you have these big, you know, gerbils hanging in front of your face, it's a very distracting thing. And so we ended up actually having to bring out the podium, mic it up. Eventually, later on, they were actually micing me up, putting a remote mic on my tie. And it just got more and more elaborate as time went on. It wasn't something that we planned. In retrospect, it worked very well, but I can tell you again that I ended up in that role simply as a way to improve the transparency, and I think that helped tremendously. And I can tell you the one thing that helped more than anything else in our dealing with the public and the press is that unlike so many of the other venues, the decisions of the Florida Supreme Court, when I went out to read the bottom line result, everybody got the same information at the same time, the public and the press. And that was the best way we could be fair to everybody. And at that point in time, given the technology, that was the only way we could be fair to everybody.
There in hindsight now, there are a couple of things that you might not think that I would get out of all of these proceedings and review. One of them is that we made a decision back when Chief Justice Harding was our Chief Justice to hire Craig as our public information officer. Craig's a very modest person, but I can tell you that he first had a very distinguished career as a journalist before he went to law school, and he did exceptionally well in law school when the justices of the Florida Supreme Court bring law school graduates to the court to work for us. It's fortunate that we really have the cream of the crop. And that's how Craig Waters came to the Florida Supreme Court, working for Justice Kogan and Justice Barquette, and later for the entire court. So when we started talking about having a public information officer, we were very fortunate to have within the court already a proven person to do that. And one of the memories that I have is Craig, and we would review what his public release was going to be about a decision that we made before we sent him out there, you know, by the way. And in other words, all the justices would have signed off on. But I can remember the night that the U.S. Supreme Court released its decision, and all they did was hand that opinion or opinions, it was a whole bunch of opinions, to the press. And you had the press that wanted to get the information out there in a hurry, standing in the glare of lights before the U.S. Supreme Court, and reading the most confusing, contradictory parts of the opinions from the majority opinion and individual justices. And as I was watching that, I didn't know what the hell had happened at the U.S. Supreme Court. Contrast that with what happened with Craig Waters and the public statements that we made. So we're deeply indebted to Craig. And the other thing that I disagree with the U.S. Supreme Court about in terms of having a public information officer is also their steadfast decision not to open up their courtroom, because I believe that opening up the courtroom of the U.S. Supreme Court would be the greatest civic education device for our judicial system that could ever be presented to the people of this country. Thanks.
We promised people a break, and they've been very patient because we're behind times because of our food issue. And I don't know why anybody would leave. Maybe your house is on fire or something. I promised you after the break we're going to start it off with a question about what our panel thinks the true historical significance of this event was in American history. And we're also going to go deep, and it's always the best part of the conversation because we're going to really get rocking and rolling. If you have to leave, we also have dessert. If you have to leave, we're so glad that you joined us. 5 minutes, and we're right. Oh, you know what? Actually, let me ask one question before you leave. Like, it has to be like a sentence for each of you, because this is a great question from the audience. Does anyone have a secret that after all these years you'd like to reveal to the world? Just maybe we can start with Justice Anstead here.
I think I revealed that when I said that the governor signed two death warrants, you know, midway into here we were overwhelmed. You know, with all of these cases, and it was quite a shock to us that the governor would pick this time to sign those death warrants. I didn't see any coverage of that, you know, during the coverage of the elections disputes.
Justice LaVarga.
The only secret that people didn't catch is the courtroom I was using was not my courtroom. It belonged to this county court judge who did basically small claims court. And he was, he had this very tropical looking palm trees with fruits hanging from it. And we were petrified that when the national television, if they caught that, and remember during the O.J. Simpson trial, how Jay Leno had the dancing Judge Eatles, remember that? And here you got the Cuban guy with a tropical plant next to him sitting on the bench. And We were afraid we're going to get like a Carmen Miranda dance, you know. So that's the only secret I have.
Barry.
I've already spilled my guts to any reporter who would listen to me.
Ion.
Well, I would say that there is an overlay of politics that we haven't discussed here at all. Some of them are potentially secret to some members. For example, I don't know if Craig or you, Justice, were aware that there was a public relations campaign put together out of South Florida through a Palm Beach County county commissioner that ended up getting convicted last year for corrupt practices that funneled over $300,000 of illegal money from Roger Stone, who is sort of a famous political trickster, to essentially wage a campaign against the Florida Supreme Court. And that was going on contemporaneously with this process. I didn't find out about it until after the fact, until after she was convicted by the Florida Elections Commission and threatened with a $200,000 fine for illegally funneling the money.
Judge Clark.
I can't think of any secrets. As a result of it, a lot of people I'd grown up with got in touch with me. Well, they knew where I was now. That's about all I can think of.
Judge Lewis.
Do I have a secret that after all these years I'd like to share? No.
Craig Waters.
Well, mine is not an entirely a secret, but it's not very well known. I inadvertently made my Aunt Ethel worldwide famous during one of the question and answer periods I gave the week of Thanksgiving. The reporters were all worried they were going to have to stay for Thanksgiving and sit outside our building. And trying to reassure them, I told them that I had an interest because I was supposed to go to my Aunt Ethel's family reunion in Alberta, Alabama. I was immediately bombarded with requests about my Aunt Ethel. She was hunted down by the television stations in her area. The Miami Herald published her Thanksgiving menu. And then the BBC, which seemed to be sublimely bored with all the counting and everything, came up to me and asked if they could actually go and film my family reunion.
Thank you. Thank you. 5 minutes and we're back. You know, I did want to say that having these really exceptional public servants here tonight, I think it makes it obviously pretty clear that this was a daunting and challenging thing that Florida undertook, and I'm just really impressed with all of you. And maybe actually we should start with elaborating on that and ask you this question. Do you all think that Florida essentially deserves to be the butt of jokes like we are on the recount? Anyone? Yeah, if you...
I don't think so. It was very unfortunate that what happened occurred. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, Teresa LaFleur, the supervisor of elections in Palm Beach County, was a fine, dedicated public servant. And I hated to see this happen to her. But she did it with good intentions. We have a lot of senior citizens in Palm Beach County, a lot of retirees. And I take it that she had a lot of complaints that they couldn't see the ballot, so she tried to help out in that way, and it just didn't work out the way it should have. But I don't want to say I resent, but I really don't like the whole idea of people making fun of us that way.
Elections are inherently messy. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of human beings. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. And I think that in every election, there's stuff that goes wrong. And the bigger the election, the more opportunities there are. But you don't have circumstances in which, number one, it makes a difference in the result of the election. It's probably in every election there are people who don't get the vote or their votes aren't counted right, but it doesn't make a difference. It's not as an important election, and it doesn't get the attention that it got. Florida happened to be in the limelight, but I would imagine there's not a state in this country that hasn't had problems similar to this. We used those same ballots for years and years and years, and nobody realized that the problems were of the magnitude they were. And we acted quickly to fix it, and we had a legal system that worked.
I'm not well-liked by most supervisors of elections because I generally focus on the problems. And Florida was a disaster waiting to happen for a close election. It exposed all of the weaknesses in our systems, technological systems that rejected votes when it shouldn't, voter registration systems that weren't accurate. We had a whole host of problems. It took the 2000 election for us to begin the process to solve it. And I think we've done that to a very large degree. There are elements that need to be completed, but we've done a great job. And Florida shouldn't be held as the dumb state of 2000 because I happen to know that in Georgia, 5% of all of their ballots were lost and discarded in the 2000 election. In New Mexico, which actually had a closer presidential election, there was no way to do any recount because all of New Mexico's votes were cast on touchscreen with no way to recount any election. So the Republican Party made the decision not even to pursue going into New Mexico because there was nothing to examine. So Florida's problems really set the stage for correcting a lot of problems that were not just present in Florida, but nationally. And I think that it had to happen or else we would go on not counting people's votes. And just to put that into perspective, 4 million votes were not counted in 2000. That number has dropped to about 2 million uncounted votes in this country, and we're still having a problem getting overseas individuals in Iraq and Afghanistan being able to vote. States like Virginia were just sanctioned. New York is being sanctioned. There's a whole host of problems. And until we make a commitment to count every vote and straighten this out, we're going to have these problems nationwide.
I've got an audience question. Was there any concern about civil unrest in the state or a country among legal, judicial, and political communities as the events unfolded?
Since I'm next, maybe I can take that one. There was not, and that's the beauty. In fact, that kind of leads into what I was going to say about whether we should be the laughingstock. From the judicial perspective, I am extremely proud to have been a part of this strong judiciary. Part of the frustration that we saw was that the media was calling this at every news break. They were saying that this country is in a constitutional crisis. And there were concerns about the downfall of this country, and the phrase that they kept using was constitutional crisis. We were never in a constitutional crisis. And that makes me extremely proud to be a part of this judiciary. And we never had a constitutional crisis because we've had a system in place for 200 years that allows us to resolve disputes, whether it's a dispute about a car crash or a dispute about a presidential election. We have systems in place, we have rules in place, and we have law in place that allows us to resolve this dispute, and I dare say extremely efficiently. So I don't think we ever had any problem like that. And in fact, it's a testament to us that the public had confidence in the rulings that the courts made. A lot of countries would not have done that. A lot of countries would not have had that confidence. If a country can say that we've been through what some called a constitutional crisis, and all we ended up with was people complaining verbally and pundits criticizing, then that's pretty darn good. We never had riots. We never had a war. We never had tanks in the street. And what that means to me is that we have a democracy that works in large part because we have a strong judicial system.
Yeah. Justice LaBarga.
Let me just amplify that. I came from a country. I was 11 years old when I came to this country, right after the so-called revolution. And I came from a country where a guy with a beard and a horrible tailor decides what the laws are. And my father and my mom, who obviously grew up in that atmosphere in this country, I remember when I was presiding over this case, and I would go to visit them at night. They live in West Palm. And on the way home, I would always stop and see my mom and dad. And my dad would just look at me and says, I can tell you how Fidel would handle this. I agree with Judge Clark. I mean, it is a testament to this country, and it is really each time we have an election, it's a celebration of our democracy, and those of us who and those of you who were born in this country and seen nothing but this, in a way we kind of take it for granted, but it really is a cause of celebration that we don't have tanks in the streets and soldiers telling you, well, this is how it's going to be. And we do that every 4 years or so.
We've got about 5 or 6 more minutes before we lose our radio audience. So I promise the question, what is the true significance of the Florida recount? You know, not the common wisdom, but the true significance to American history.
All right, I'll start. First of all, I don't think it has a lot of legal significance. There was no new meaningful precedent really set. Both courts followed past precedent. They didn't make any significant changes. I think the most significant thing about it is that it illustrated what this society can be and should be and what this organization stands for. The lawyers were civil to each other. They treated each other professionally. The courts were civil to each other. Every time a court made a decision, inferior courts followed it without an issue. The results were accepted by everybody. It's regrettable that I think that was maybe the high point in this country's civil discourse. and it's regrettable that it did not carry over into our political system, which is getting worse and worse. And that's what I think the significance of it was.
Well, Barry, I have to agree with you about the polarization and the level of extreme partisanship that, quite frankly, I saw for the first time in the 2000 election. As an election practitioner, I tend to focus just on elections and not look too broadly about. But the thing that shocked me was the extent to which partisans could care less about the actual numbers of an election. They just wanted to win at all costs, regardless of what it took, who they had to run over, who they had to bury. They didn't care. And that aspect is still with our society. If you look at litigation post and pre-2000, it's off the charts. The 2000 election now has basically meant that elections are a very commonly litigated issue. And I don't think that's going to change because, unfortunately, the dynamics of the process are highly polarized. And until we have a discussion of how we actually can discuss issues where we differ and solve these problems with real solutions as opposed to attacking each other and demonizing each other, we're not going to deal with this problem.
I certainly don't see a problem with people hiring lawyers, though.
Okay, anyone else? We've got a couple more minutes before you have to break for the radio.
Yes, I would like to just point out something that I noticed. In many ways, you can view what happened here in Tallahassee 10 years ago as the last of the civil discourse in our public life, or the beginning of the cruder discourse that we have today. But the one thing that really struck me about the 2000 election cases, you have to keep in mind that 10 months later was 9/11. The terrorist attacks of 9/11 happened. And I can tell you, 10 years ago, I didn't live behind security barriers and blast-proof windows. Today, I do. 10 years ago, I could afford to go out into the streets of Tallahassee and make public announcements about the opinions of the Florida Supreme Court. Today, law enforcement officers would not let me do that. And so we have lost something in the last 10 years for a variety of reasons. And for that reason, I think I almost sense a kind of nostalgia here in Tallahassee for what happened 10 years ago.
Anyone else? Last words. Sort of last words.
I wonder if I think this is a point that could close on, and I'd like for Judge Clark just to mention this, because she told me a story about the time sometime later when she was in Liberia as an election judge, and we have about 1 minute. But if you could just tell me about the occasion when you went into that courthouse and what you saw as a coda to this discussion.
A couple of years after our election, I got a call from the Department of State asking if I would join a couple of lawyers from the Department of State from the U.S. Attorney's Office to go to Liberia. Liberia was about to have, it's a small country in West Africa, they were about to have their first ever democratic presidential election. They longed for a way to be able to resolve the anticipated election disputes in the way that we had. Hearing that, I gladly went, and it was one of the most exciting experiences of my life, among the most important legal work that I've ever done, that I had a chance to teach the various judges, the elections judges and the Supreme Court judges in Liberia, West Africa, about how to resolve election disputes so that they are resolved in the courts and not on the streets. This country was coming out of 14 years of civil war, and part of the peace accord required that they have democratic presidential election. And one of the most striking things during my visit was to walk to the Supreme Court in Liberia. And I realized for the first time that when there's a revolution, when there's civil war, the first thing that people do is tear down the courthouse. courthouse.
Judge Clark, I'm sorry. We need to break off for the radio audience and say thank you so much for joining us. We hope you'll come back again another event. Good night.
You've been listening to a special delayed broadcast of the November 9th, 2010 forum of From the Village Square, the Florida Recount Plus 10 Years. Join us again next time for From the Village Square on WFSU-FM.
Local support for this program is provided by public radio listeners and the Rivers team of Keller Williams Town & Country Realty, a Tallahassee real estate resource, providing services that include 7-day, 9-to-9 service, a customer moving van, and full-service relocation. The Rivers team at RainTheRivers.com. Native Nurseries, a source for wild bird seed, feeders and baths, binoculars and plants for wildlife for over 30 years. Native Nurseries, located on Centerville Road in Tallahassee, and on the web at NativeNurseries.com.
The forecast for the Tallahassee area.